They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Welcome again to Necessary and Proper. Today we bring you the great discussion we had from the closing panel of the 2019 Legislative Branch Review Conference, held on the Hill in February in partnership with the Federal Society's Georgetown Student Chapter. The panel reflected on the history of bipartisan congressional investigations and shared their expectations for how civil, united, and fact-based they expect the oversight of the 116th Congress will be. We hope you find this podcast interesting and enjoyable.
We are now ready to start our third and final panel discussion of the day. Its theme is bipartisanship and high-profile congressional investigations. We are pleased to have with us another great panel and another great moderator. Our moderator is Justin Rood. Justin is the director of POGO's Congressional Oversight Initiative. Previously, he served under Senator Tom Coburn on his Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee as director of investigations on Homeland Security matters. Prior to that, he worked under Senator Coburn as a senior investigator on the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, Minority Staff. And before that, Mr. Rood was an award-winning investigative producer and reporter with ABC News and other outlets. His undergraduate degree is in American and United States Studies from Pitzer College. With that, Justin, thank you for joining us, and thank you for offering to moderate this great panel.
Thank you, and thanks for having us. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here, especially because we have a fantastic panel of folks to talk about congressional oversight today. To my immediate right is Elise Bean. Elise is the co-director of the Levin Center at Wayne Law. She was counsel for former Senator Carl Levin and spent many years as his staff director and chief counsel for the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, where I first got to know her and work with her. At PSI, she led many successful investigations on a range of issues from money laundering, foreign corruption and offshore tax abuses to the collapse of Enron and the 2008 financial crisis. She's the author of a new book, Financial Exposure, Carl Levin Senate Investigations into Finance and Tax Abuse. And since we're outing everyone from where they went to school, she got her undergraduate degree from Wesleyan and her law degree from the University of Michigan Law School. To her right, we have Stanley Brand, who is a senior counsel at Akin Gump. His practice covers all level of state and federal courts with an emphasis on defending the rights of witnesses involved in government investigations. Mr. Brand has represented numerous individuals and organizations investigated by and or called to testify before Congress. He previously served as general counsel to the House of Representatives under Tip O'Neill, which was the subject of a fantastic podcast I just listened to. I recommend it to everyone. His undergraduate degree is from Franklin and Marshall College. His JD is from Georgetown University. And to his right is John Scledaney, the chief counsel for oversight to the minority on the House Committee on Financial Services. He previously served as the staff director at what was until recently known as the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. His undergraduate degree is from the College of William and Mary, and his JD is from George Mason. So we'll start with presentations from each of our panelists. Elise, would you like to go first?
Sure. Okay. Maybe I should turn that on. So there are two models of congressional oversight that I think are going to duke it out in the 116th Congress. One is looking at oversight as a substantive mechanism to get information and perform the function of checks and balances in our government. The other model is oversight as political theater. And the story of the 116th Congress is which one of these models is really going to win out. The authority to investigate is not laid out in the Constitution, but the Supreme Court found that it was inherent in the legislative functions carried out by Congress. If you're going to legislate, if you're going to appropriate, if you're going to nominate, Wouldn't it be a good thing to get the facts? In addition to getting information so that you can act in an informed manner, we have the separation of powers under the Constitution, the idea that one part of government will act as a check on the other parts to prevent abuses. Those are really the two main purposes, from my eyes, for congressional oversight. But there's another view of oversight, which is political theater. In other words, it's not really to get information. It's not really to check abuses. It is really to score points. It's to set up elections. It's to persuade a popular opinion. To me, that's a corruption of oversight. That's not what it's about as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. But I have to admit, it's got some validity as a way of understanding what happens in Congress in some hearings. One thing to think about in the 116th Congress that's new is Speaker Pelosi. She's really set a tone and provided a role model for House committee chairs doing oversight. I think some of her messages are avoid the extreme rhetoric, don't act off the cuff, assert the power of a responsible, co-equal branch of government. And I think that's the message that she's been giving. And we have committee chairs in the House in particular that have been really around the block before. So we've got people like Elijah Cummings at Oversight and Reform, Frank Pallone at Energy and Commerce, Jerry Nadler at Judiciary. If you just go down the list, we have very experienced people. Maxine Waters at Financial Services, Richard Neal at Ways and Means, Raul Grijalva at Natural Resources. The list goes on and on. These are people who have been in the majority before. They know that oversight can help drive real change, and it can be something much more than just theater. If we look at what's happened so far in terms of what's coming up, there's a real tension in oversight. Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. There's a lot of pressure from the media and from the base of both parties to sort of take those short-term, feel-good, cheap shots versus having a more long-term, bipartisan type of investigation. At the Levin Center, we think bipartisan investigations are still the gold standard. It's easier to get information when both sides are looking for it. You get better analysis when you do investigations with people who have different viewpoints. Different people ask for different details. They understand the facts differently. They understand the issues differently. And you get your end product is more thorough. It's more accurate. And usually it's more credible if both sides are involved. So we think that's the gold standard. But the question is, what's really going to happen? And there are different ways you can analyze what's going on. For example, House Armed Services Committee announced it wanted to have a hearing looking at the whole thing of sending troops to the border. Now, you can look at that as a partisan issue, but a different way to look at it is, are we performing, is Congress performing that separation of powers, checks and balances function that the Constitution envisioned? It could go either way. The topic, depending on how it's handled and who's involved and how the hearing unfolds, it could go either way. There are a lot of other hearings like that as well. At Oversight and Reform, their first hearing was about price gouging in the drug industry. That's really a bipartisan concern. President Trump has expressed many times his concern about excessive drug prices, but it depends on, again, how it's going to unfold. That same committee invited Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to talk about adding a citizenship question to the next census. Again, you could see that as a partisan issue. On the other hand, you could see it as Congress performing the function it's really supposed to be doing. And there are other examples. We can go on. Energy and Commerce, traditionally a pretty bipartisan committee in the House. They're looking at drug prices in terms of companies violating patent limits. They're looking at the impacts of the shutdown. Again, could see it as a partisan political theater, or you could see it as, no, let's really talk about shutdown as a policy matter. What are the problems? They also take into account cybersecurity, something that Senator Graham was just talking about. Looking at it, they've been actually going on an agency-by-agency basis trying to analyze their cybersecurity safeguards. So there's a lot of possibility for bipartisan, meaningful, intellectually honest oversight. But again, that temptation is to go turn everything into a political conversation. That's certainly what the media likes. If you tell the media we have a bipartisan hearing coming up, they go, oh, that means it's boring. I don't need to cover it. There's a lot of bipartisanship that still goes on in this Congress. people know that bipartisan inquiries really drive change, whether it's legislation, appropriations, nominations, and a lot of people still work very hard to reach out to the other side. So I'm hopeful about what's going to happen. Certainly, and one of the tests, I just want to give one last example, is Ways and Means. One of the things they're looking at are the Trump tax returns. Now, it's easy to say that's a partisan approach. But if your intention is to embarrass the president, that's not a constitutional basis for congressional oversight. That couldn't fly in court. But on the other hand, if the reason you want to look at those tax returns are, well, here's a very wealthy person who apparently doesn't pay much taxes, how did that happen? What's going on in our tax code that allows people legally to not pay taxes despite having very high incomes? Are there real estate tax deductions that are overly generous? Then you get into a substantive policy discussion. Are there things in his tax returns that might indicate conflicts of interest, either domestic or foreign? Again, a more substantive concern. If that's why you're looking at those tax returns, well, then you have a very good chance of surviving a court challenge. So again, we're going to have to see how things play out. There's a tension, there's a testing going on, both with the public and within Congress and with the Trump administration. Congress's approval rating right now is hovering around 15%. It could go lower, but oversight actually has an opportunity. If Congress does it well in a bipartisan, intellectually honest way, they could actually improve the reputation of Congress and help to start to restore public confidence in Congress.
Great. Stan?
Thank you. Just riffing off Senator Graham's comment about everybody's been the lawyer has been the butt of a joke. In 1982, I was counsel to the House when Madeleine Murray O'Hare, who some of you might be old enough to remember, was an atheist and sued over prayer in the public schools. And then she turned her ire to the House chaplain and she sued the chaplain alleging that, and the House leadership alleging that the chaplain was an unconstitutional establishment of religion. So it fell to me to defend that case. And it got to the D.C. Circuit in banc. It was very volatile and acrimonious oral argument. And after the argument, I walked out with the House chaplain, whose office, ironically, was right next door to mine. We used to trade off clients. And he turned to me and he tugged on my sleeve very plaintively and he said, "Stan, how do you think it went?" And I said, "Chaplain, I can only say it's a very sad day when a man of the cloth turns to a lawyer to be saved." We did save him. Well, I think Elise's foundation is excellent to go off of. And what I'm concerned about mostly is when Congress gets to an impasse with the president or the Justice Department over subpoenas, as they inevitably will, how in the world is that going to be resolved? And when the press breathlessly calls me for comment when subpoenas are issued and say, "Oh my God, a subpoena has been issued." And I, without being too flip, will say, you know, call me in 2 years when the litigation battle is over. Don't put a headline out that a subpoena has been issued, because in truth, it's just a piece of paper. It has to be enforced. Now, what is the history of enforcement of congressional subpoenas against executive branch officials? Going all the way back to 1982, when I was counsel to the House, and we, several House committees subpoenaed the administrator of the EPA during an investigation into oversight of the Superfund law. And the administrator of the EPA was Ann Gorsuch. Yes, that Gorsuch, the mother of the new Supreme Court justice. And the committee subpoenaed the records. To make a long story short, the Justice Department asserted executive privilege. Ronald Reagan signed the claim of privilege over what was called enforcement-sensitive files, because what the committee wanted to find out was, how are they administering the Superfund? Are they doing it properly? And does it need amendment or change? And the department took the position that, well, that's interfering in our law enforcement processes by looking over our shoulder at the decisions we have made or about to make on individual cases. And so they got to an impasse, and the committee referred Ann Gorsuch to the floor for contempt. I think the highest ranking of government official ever held in contempt by a vote of the House, maybe Eric Holder later in the process. And by a bipartisan vote with 70 Republicans joining the Democrats in a case putting the Republican-appointed administrator in contempt, the case was sent off to the U.S. attorney under the contempt statute, 2 U.S.C. 192, except that unlike virtually every case that had been brought under the statute since 1857, the department determined not to present it to the grand jury, even though the statute says shall. There's a separate debate about whether they have the discretion not to send it to the grand jury under that section. They turned around and at the stroke of 11 o'clock at night after the contempt, they filed a lawsuit against the House of Representatives styled U.S. v. U.S. House of Representatives, if you can get your head around that. My position in the court was, well, you can't be the United States if you're not enforcing the sovereign's laws. So the most you could be would be the executive branch versus the House of Representatives. We moved, their theory was this should be settled in a civil way, not under the criminal statute, and that the whole contempt process as applied to Gorsuch was unconstitutional because it unnecessarily burdened the president's claim of privilege. That lawsuit was quickly dismissed on motion by the House of Representatives, which I filed and argued, and the judge held that no, if you have defenses to the congressional subpoena, like executive privilege, tell it to the jury and the judge in your contempt case. And until a contempt case is actually presented, your claims of executive privilege won't have to be determined by this court. After the dismissal of the case, the department did not seek an appeal. And the committees negotiated with the department. I negotiated with a guy named Ed Schmaltz, who was deputy attorney general. And we reached a agreement where the committee got access, in fact, actually got copies of some of the records. And the case went away. However, it spawned progeny, which we live with to this day, which is essentially that subpoenas for executive branch officials raising claims of privilege who are referred via the statute to the U.S. attorney are never going to be prosecuted or have their case presented to a grand jury because the department has taken the institutional position through both Democratic and Republican administrations. Although this was invented by my good friend and colleague Ted Olson when he was at the Justice Department, Democratic administrations jumped on this theory as well. And so the Department of Justice's position became, we're never going to enforce this statute against an executive branch official who's claiming privilege, which has forced the House to resort to, ironically, the civil lawsuit mode that we moved to dismiss in 1982. So there are two cases, Harriet Myers during the Bush administration and the Judiciary Committee's investigation of the firing of various U.S. attorneys, where the House passed a resolution. Irv Nathan, then the House counsel, went off to federal court, filed a declaratory judgment action, and the case was heard by Judge Bates. Judge Bates got past all the jurisdictional and jurisprudential threshold arguments about standing, ripeness, et cetera, and ruled that the case was properly in the court. But that took almost a year without ever getting to the merits. Eventually, the party settled because they were afraid of an appeal where they might lose something important for the future. The bottom line of it being, and then the Holder case, which was the fast and furious investigation conducted by Oversight, I believe, in the Holder era, where they went off to court, and that case, I think, was 6 years in the making or more. So it's maybe ongoing. Yes, it's not. John advises me it's still on the docket. So what I'm going to conclude with is this notion that there is really no speedy, efficient way to resolve congressional subpoena battles between the president and the Congress. And if what we expect to happen is a series of investigations, even well-founded ones that are not blatantly or prima facie exercises of political theater, are going to take a long time to resolve, because there's only one way that that can happen, and that is through a civil lawsuit. And of course, the Article III judges are reluctant to referee disputes between the branches unless there is no escape from doing so. When private parties are involved, they are much more likely to cross that threshold, as they did in the Steele seizure cases or other cases. But where it's the president and the Congress banging heads, they don't want to be the referees, even where the House or the Senate shows up with standing and has a, you know, a live case or controversy. So, yes, there will be a lot of drama in the fight between the newly run Democratic committees in the House and the executive branch, and there will be a lot of lawyer time and effort spent. How this will ultimately get resolved in our lifetime is another question. And maybe what that counsels is that we have to find other ways. Now, I'm a litigator, so I thrive on that type of action. And if it is the duty of the courts to say what the law is, then they should be able to say it with respect to congressional subpoenas. So I look forward to it from a lawyer's standpoint, but from an oversight standpoint or a efficiency of government standpoint, I think it's going to be a very long couple of years. And what the House committees are going to have to do and be very careful about is husbanding the cases that they bring to court. They're going to have to make some very difficult decisions about what kind of case to bring, what kind of record to make to substantiate, as Elise points out, the basis for their oversight, and be patient in dealing with the courts, because once it gets into court, that's really just the beginning. And so, you know, you're going to hear a lot of things about the Congress's ability to investigate, to have the public know. Of course, that's not the basis for congressional oversight. The so-called informing function that the Congress has is to inform itself in connection with its Article I capabilities, not to publish the work to the world what it is involved in. That may be a byproduct, but that can't be the purpose. So we're going to be witnessing, I think, a very active and interesting set of legal issues that will play out over the next year or more as we see whether and how the Congress can enforce their right to have this information.
So, John, in an era of bitter partisanship, with powers that are of limited utility, at least in the short term, within the event horizon of a Congress, how do you manage to get anything done?
That's a very good question, and I think Elise and Stan hit on exactly the challenges that we as congressional investigators deal with on a regular basis. I've spent my entire career, 10 years in the House as an investigator. I was indoctrinated into the Article I frame of mind early on by my colleagues who had lived through a lot of the interbranch disputes that Stan and Elise described. And Stan really nailed the practical challenges and the realities that we deal with when it comes time to enforce our subpoenas. The reality is that Congress has to rely on the other two branches to enforce the subpoenas, and that inherently diminishes our Article I authority. We rely on the executive branch to enforce criminal penalties against individuals who are held in contempt. Stan explained why that typically does not happen. And with respect to obtaining the documents that were covered by the subpoena in the first place, the documents and information that we considered so key to our investigation, as far as actually getting our hands on those via the subpoena, we have to turn to the judiciary, which can take years, and there's no guarantee of a satisfactory result when you get to the decision. So I think the best way to answer Justin's question might be to describe one of the more effective investigations that we did at the Oversight Committee while I was there. The case dates all the way back to 2012, involving the Secret Service and a trip to Cartagena. There were, if you recall, a number of agents had too much to drink, interacted with prostitutes, and really sort of created a national security risk by exposing some sensitive information, not to mention embarrassing the agency and the country. So the committee examined the facts related to that trip and identified some obvious problems, especially relating to training and morale at the agency. Over the next several years, there were a series of security breaches at the White House, including fence jumpers, and one individual even made it all the way inside the White House. And it became clear in the course of our oversight of each of those incidents that the Secret Service was an agency in crisis. So it became sort of a full-blown investigation at that point, and dozens of whistleblowers came forward from the agency to tell the committee what was going on. And of course, we needed documents from the agency to really do a full assessment of the situation. Unfortunately for us, the Secret Service is a component of the Department of Homeland Security, and DHS has a well-deserved reputation for really pushing the boundaries in terms of obstructing congressional oversight. They refuse to accept service of subpoenas, just as one example. Most everybody will accept a subpoena by email as a professional courtesy, not DHS. The department's lawyers routinely assert privileges that we don't recognize. They withhold embarrassing documents, and they just generally try to make our jobs as difficult as they possibly can. And those lawyers are fully aware of the challenges we face with respect to enforcing our subpoenas. They know everything that Stan just described, and they are entirely comfortable sort of developing a playbook around those weaknesses. But this case turned out to be a little different, and there's a key reason why, and it's because in that case, Chairman Chaffetz and Ranking Member Cummings partnered up. They made joint requests for information. Witness interviews and depositions were coordinated. There was a great deal of interaction between the respective staffs in terms of developing an investigative plan, coordinating press releases, and really every step of the way, it was a bipartisan process. The whistleblowers who were coming to the committee, each side had equal access to them. And when the DHS lawyers recognized that the chairman and the ranking member were completely aligned, their posture changed. The documents we obtained showed the Secret Service had a cultural problem, and that explained for us why there was such a high attrition rate, why there were staffing shortfalls, and the root causes of the misconduct in Cartagena and the security breaches at the White House started to come into focus. And with that understanding, Chairman Chaffetz and Ranking Member Cummings were able to work together on legislation that improved morale at the agency by ensuring agents were properly trained and that they received pay for the overtime that they worked, which turned out to be a huge issue. The rank and file were also sort of boosted in terms of their morale by the fact that there was some accountability for the senior management who they believed had sort of looked the other way with respect to misconduct amongst themselves. I believe the Secret Service was a stronger institution at the end of our investigation than it was at the beginning, and I think that's a good indicator that it was a successful oversight venture. And that was really only possible because of the bipartisan approach to the case, and I think it's a good model for investigations in the 116th Congress. Early in my career, veteran investigators in the House and the Senate really helped me understand the purpose of congressional oversight, which I think Elise nailed. And they helped me understand the tools that are available to us. They also helped me understand that it took a long time for Congress to win the right to issue subpoenas, to compel witnesses to testify, to charge witnesses with perjury and contempt. And they also helped me understand that those powers should be wielded methodically and with a full understanding of the legal implications for the people on the receiving end. After 10 years now, it's also become clear to me that those powers are really at their strongest when they're wielded on a bipartisan basis. Bipartisan investigations send a message that the committee has the backing it needs from the full House or the full Senate in the event that a subpoena needs to be enforced. Bipartisan investigations also signal that running out the clock is not an option. The issue is not going to go away. Both sides are interested, and the investigation will continue no matter who sits in the chair in the next Congress. Bipartisan investigations are also more likely to lead to legislation and other reforms because you have buy-in, of course, from both sides. But I think most importantly, bipartisan investigations protect the institutional interests of Congress. A bipartisan investigation involves joint document requests, joint interviews, typically an agreement with respect to the scope and plan for the investigation. The shared goal being to establish a set of facts that both sides can agree on. And the findings and recommendations that arise from that common set of facts may diverge. I don't think that's unusual or even problematic. I think that's healthy. But the findings from each side are considerably more credible when the underlying facts are not in dispute. So when both sides share the goal of obtaining every document or piece of testimony, then the committee is more likely to be successful when they use the different oversight tools. And it's been my experience that every time a witness from the executive branch complies with a subpoena out of apprehension that the alternative is worse, then the committee and the institution gets a little stronger. Those muscles get a little stronger. And I think that's a good shared objective for all of us in the next few years.
I want to ask my first question to the panel. Over time, over the last several decades, power shifted between the executive branch and the legislative branch. Popular narrative has Congress kind of ascendant in the post-Watergate era when oversight and transparency issues became important and it was a muscular body. Post 9/11, there was a strong shift towards the executive. I've never been yelled at more on the phone than I was a reporter talking to Watergate era investigators. I was covering Congress. I was talking to Watergate era investigators around 2003, 2004, who saw me as an outlet for their frustrations for how weak Congress was being and not standing up for their prerogatives. Where do you think we stand now? And is there a trend or is there a direction that we're going?
I think we're further behind than when you spoke to the press or to the committee. If you look at not just in the area of congressional oversight, if you look at war powers and the number of undeclared wars that we are waging, if you look at first strike capability and how Congress gets involved in that decision across the board, there's further atrophy. And I think that's been exacerbated by the turnover in Congress and the fact that many of the people who come to Congress, again, on both sides of the aisle, don't come from a legislative background. They come from some other profession or walk of life. And so they arrive at the Capitol without a fully developed view of what, in the late, great Raoul Berger's words, are the vast armamentarium of powers residing in Article One. And so they need more orientation to understand what their powers are and how they've been exercised historically over the last several hundred years. So I think we're still behind the curve on that as far as Article One is concerned.
I'd like to offer a contrary view. So I was in Congress for 30 years working for Levin doing investigations. He retired in early 2015. I did too. We set up a nonprofit called the Levin Center. We work with POGO doing training in the oversight area. We have boot camps twice a year. Get people from the House, the Senate, Democrats, Republicans. We put them on bipartisan, bicameral teams, give them fake scandals, sort of take them through the process to teach them how to strengthen their investigative abilities. We've now trained over 165 investigative staff. We had our first training for administrative staff. We had over 40 people show up to that. And I have to say, I've been pretty impressed with the people that show up. Contrary to how Congress is portrayed in the press as dysfunctional, gridlocked, you know, a black hole, paralyzed, that was not my personal experience, and it hasn't been my experience while we've been doing that training. We have experienced members of Congress. We have some staff members who have been around 20 years, 10 years. That doesn't mean most people are experienced. There are lots of people. The average tenure on the Hill for staff is about 4 years. I think the pay, as Senator Graham was talking about earlier, has something to do with that. But even so, the people that come here are still incredibly smart. They're dedicated. They're interested in government that works. And I have been pleasantly surprised through my career that just getting out the facts actually has a policy impact. And I've seen many, many investigations. They tend to be the bipartisan investigations, as John was talking about, but having a real impact on information, perception, and policy reforms. Some examples: after Enron, we had, you know, the SOX thing was, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act was passed. If you want to look at the financial crisis, we had Dodd-Frank, which for all of its faults is still a very powerful bill. There are many, many other instances that I could go through of policy results from oversight investigations. That doesn't mean it's easy. It's very difficult. I find the investigations that take a year are often more powerful and have more of an impact than those that take 3 weeks, for example. Those are the ones that tend not to have much of an impact. But I do think that oversight, contrary to how it's portrayed in the press likes to concentrate on the least attractive oversight hearings we have, the Benghazi ones that go on for 11 hours where every question that's been asked has already been asked seven times before. That makes Congress look very dysfunctional, very incompetent. But if you look at a lot of oversight hearings that get no press, there are actually very sophisticated investigations that I think do some very worthwhile work. I think the ones that go after the private sector abuses are often more effective than those going after the government. Justin and I, though, we did a one that was led by Senator Coburn into fusion centers at DHS. We had the same experience. The DHS was absolutely outrageous, but we continued for over a year, and we were able to get the information we needed and had a report that had a lot of important information. So that's been my personal experience and what I've seen as I've gotten into the oversight training space.
I'll just add that I think there has been a little bit of a resurgence in the last few Congresses ever since the oversight function was expanded. In the House, the Oversight and Government Reform Committee had sort of been the sole committee that did oversight and investigations. And now just about every committee in the House has an O&I function. I think that has helped as the different committees sort of develop staff with expertise within the jurisdiction of that committee, and they develop the skill set to go out and do long-term legitimate investigations of the issues that matter to their bosses. I think that has made people on the receiving end of oversight a little bit more familiar with the process, comfortable with the process, which, believe it or not, actually helps. So that I have seen as a positive development. On the other hand, I think the secret is sort of out at this point, that the secret that Stan described, that enforcing our subpoenas is extremely challenging, and that has sort of neutralized the subpoena as an oversight tool to some extent.
We have a room full of lawyers, so we're going to talk a lot about process and subpoenas and things. I'm not a lawyer, and I also remember that when we had trouble enforcing our requests and subpoenas, that we frequently relied on so-called soft power, unofficial holdings of withholdings of funds or holding up a nominee or things like that. First, I just want to, I don't think there's any disagreement on the panel that those are acceptable uses of congressional authority to get compliance. But it does require, in many cases, if you're not with a powerful senior chairman or something like that, the ability to reach to another office or another committee for help, which requires a sense of institutionalism. One of the knocks on Congress, and I think this goes to both sides of the aisle, is that there are fewer institutionalists here now than there were. And as we approach issues that come to a major conflict between branches, as impeachment or the I word, depending on who your leader is, these issues start to become in kind of starker relief. So I guess my question to you guys, and I would start with John on this, is when you look around, when you come into the office and look around, do you see a lack of institutionalists?
I really don't. At this point, I think the sort of community of House investigators, we share a lot of the same DNA. We care deeply about the House's prerogatives. We've worked on, a lot of us trace back to Fast and Furious, and that was a scenario where we really had to sort of defend the House's access to a certain category of documents, which the executive branch said we were not entitled to. They tried to expand the definition of executive privilege to the point that it would almost make oversight impossible. And I think so many of us are aware of that fact pattern and understand the importance of pushing back aggressively to defend the institution. I think, you know, maybe there aren't folks who have been here, too many folks who have been here 20, 25, 30 years at this point, but I do think there's a pretty deep understanding of the importance of defending the prerogatives of the House. And that's what you learn on day one when you get hired.
Mm-hmm. I'll just mention that people are also very creative in how they go around enforcing subpoenas. One example I have, this is not executive branch, but we were looking at into the financial crisis, and Senator Levin had issued subpoenas to a number of different financial institutions, including Goldman Sachs. And pretty much everybody had started to turn over documents except for them. And Senator Levin then called us into the office and said, I want you to take the deposition of the CEO, Lloyd Blankfein. And we said, well, usually we start at the bottom and work up, and we don't have any documents, so, you know, that's going to make the deposition very difficult. He said, you ask him everything you want to know. Our depositions normally last. They're full-day depositions. We called Mr. Blankfein in. We did depose him for the full day. We did ask him everything we wanted to know. At the end of it, we said our next person that we're going to ask to come in is the president of Goldman Sachs, then Gary Cohen, and we're going to go through your entire executive suite, unless perhaps you have some documents you'd like to give us, and then maybe we won't have to do these full-day depositions. And about a week later, they went from giving us nothing to eventually they gave us 40 million pages of documents. Senator Levin wouldn't even allow us to tell anybody how much information we had gotten in because he thought nobody would believe it. And they were trying to sort of snow us under. It didn't actually work. There are a lot of ways to try to get information aside from going to court. It does come down to, as Senator Graham said, a respect for the rule of law, that there is a certain shared understanding about separation of powers and checks and balances and the right of Congress to get information. And that is a fight that you have to have. And sometimes we would call people in, we call them, you know, for a two-hour meeting, just going through with them, what is your legal basis for not turning over this information, going line by line by line. It can be difficult. It can take a long time. They call up your boss. But in our 30 years, we got most of the information that we asked for. We were prepared to go to court. PSI had a famous case recently on Backpage.com where they went to court. It did take 2 years, 3 years, but they did win. They got a million pages of documentation. Again, it was not from the executive branch. It was a private sector entity, which is different. But Congress still has a lot of ability to get information.
It has one other informal tool, which I know has been used by both Democratic and Republican committees, controlled committees, and that is there are people in these agencies, professionals, career people, who are more than happy to drop things over the transom that establish either the basis for what is going on in the agency or probable cause for the committee to ask good questions and probe deeper. So, and those employees tend to see themselves as owing loyalty to the mission of the agency as opposed to the political appointees. And that's something that, in my experience, the committees have exploited to their benefit so that they're not, you know, going in cold when they start. They have some basis for understanding the policies, the execution of the law that they are looking into. So that, that and I expect that's going to happen to a huge degree in the ensuing period of time.
We hear stories about the breakdown of bipartisanship in oversight and investigations in small ways in the halls here on the House and Senate side, both how the majority doesn't work with the minority on a particular project. They spring hearings and interviews on them in the last minute. They don't consult before they're sending request letters and things like that. What's wrong with this way of operating and what can be done to change it? Elise?
Well, if you actually believe in oversight as a way to get information and to act as a check on abuses, having these sort of short-term battles doesn't get you anywhere. It is hard if one side is really being obnoxious to the other side, but there's a different way to operate. And one of the things we say in our training is, it's no fun to come to work in combat mode every day. Even if your bosses have certain positions that they do not like to compromise with the other side, you don't have to carry that on to a staff level. And the staff level can cooperate with each other and treat each other with respect and civility. That's where it starts to happen. We also encourage a lot of social interactions. You start to realize people on the other side of the aisle are not monsters. They are not terrible people. They are actually pretty much like you, and there is actually a lot of common ground. That's a difficult lesson for a lot of people to believe. In Washington, sometimes it feels like treasonous if you talk to somebody on the other side, much less have a friend on the other side. But we try to model that behavior for people and let them know it's okay. So on the staff level, I feel like we've made a lot of progress in the last few years. On the member level, there's a lot of pressure out there. There are donors put pressure on leaders, who put pressure on committee chair, who put pressure on their members not to cooperate or to take very extreme positions. One of the things that we need is we need the public to decide if that's what they want. There are a lot of people out there that say, yeah, I don't want my member of Congress to compromise. I want them to fight all the time. If that's the position that their constituents take, it becomes very difficult for members to act in, to accept compromise, to think it's not a dirty word, but an honorable way to proceed with people who's, who have different viewpoints. So part of it comes back to the public, the voting public, about what they really want. But there is a lot of bipartisanship that goes on in Congress all the time, because everybody knows if you really want something to happen, if you actually care about substantive results, you really need to reach across the aisle.
I started my career in the minority, then spent time in the majority, now back in the minority. And so I'm sensitive to both sides. And I'll sort of revert back to something I mentioned earlier. I think the best investigations are when there are a shared set of facts and both sides are aimed at obtaining as many facts as they possibly can. And so when you have one side or the other either withholding information or sabotaging interviews, not giving a heads up or not offering adequate time to the other side to prepare for an interview, then it becomes very difficult to reach that place where you have a shared set of facts where it's safe and appropriate for either side to sort of draw their own conclusions. You can never reach that point if you're fighting about process the whole way, or if you're walking into a deposition and you feel like one side or the other is effectively defense counsel for the witness, and making objections and throwing up roadblocks to prevent the committee from obtaining information. And that's when you run into those institutional concerns that we've talked about. I think it's in everyone's interest to be mindful of the institution, to work together to obtain as much information as we can and to be aligned towards that goal, and then save the disagreement for once we have the complete record.
I'd like to quote Congressman Elijah Cummings, who said, don't be bitter, be better. And that was when people said, even though they felt they had been not treated as well as they should have been in the past, that he wanted to set a new tone, a different way of doing things, to be more bipartisan, to be more fair on both sides, no matter, you know, forget the history, let's try to do better. Now, of course, this is all very positive. We all know the pressures are out there not to be that way, to take those political cheap shots. And so it's a battle. It's going to be a continuing battle to try to have better norms, better principles, better traditions of sharing information and working together in all the ways that you describe. But it is possible because I've seen it.
Stan, did you? I wanted to ask another question of the panel along similar lines. There's a classic model of congressional oversight that relies heavily on being or at least maintaining the appearance of reasonability. And certainly conducting an investigation in a bipartisan way lends great credence and credibility to the reasonability of an inquiry. But it goes all the way down to the way that you tailor your requests, the way that you write lines of questioning for a hearing, things like this, that it appears to be a fair inquiry. And the burden is on the subject also to appear reasonable. And in a political context, the notion that go off onto a tangent of the death of the middle or the disappearing middle, but that there is this idea of appearing at least reasonable and responsible, and that it's the other side of this inquiry that is that's getting out of line. However, I think recently both parties have seen strong political benefits to speaking to the base, the so-called base, as opposed to that middle. This can come into play in any realm of legislating or governing, but in the context of oversight, especially as we're rapidly, I think, approaching some very kind of, it seems like this an institution full of third rails at the moment, I think, for every committee looking into oversight. Do you see that phenomenon as affecting the process itself, if both sides are speaking to their base?
I do. And I don't want this to be construed politically. It's not. But when I saw the Michael Cohen fiasco of having this guy come into a committee to be asked about, according to his lawyer, stories about Donald Trump, and not being able to tie what Michael Cohen was going to testify to the jurisdiction of the committee, which is the operation and functioning of the federal government, you have to think, well, what is going on here if the committee hasn't bothered to establish the legal predicates of pertinency and jurisdiction for its inquiry? And actually, I saw the letter from the minority, which I think pointed out some of these things. And that seeps into the public's mind. And they say, well, what is this about? At first, again, just as a lawyer, what is Michael Cohen's, what relevant pertinent information does he have for that committee, given what we know publicly about what he has been charged with and what he's pled guilty to? So I think, again, people, Democrats and Republicans, need to be careful about framing their oversight inquiries around things that the rules of the House and Senate have delegated to them, and that under the case law are pertinent to that subject matter. And, you know, I've been accused of being overly fastidious about legal requirements, like the elements of the contempt statute by which the Congress enforces its subpoenas. You know, someday these things are going to get to a court. And if you're not concerned about that and you're just interested in parading a witness in front of the Klieg lights with no apparent concern about those issues, you're going to undermine public confidence. More importantly, you're going to undermine judicial deference to your inquiry because judges want to see what the legal basis is. And I think sometimes people forget that at some point when it comes to enforcing these, a judge is going to look at it. So I caution everybody to pay more attention to that than I've seen sometimes. And I think that's going to be a challenge for the Democrats. And I say that as, you know, a guy who worked for Tip O'Neill. So, you know, I when it comes to separation of powers and constitutional principles, I think you have to, you know, you have to leave your political hat to the side.
I think this whole idea of speaking just to your base is a complete mistake. When you get an echo chamber, you don't get as good an investigation as if you actually deal with people who see things differently. One of the things I learned over the years is that when you deal with somebody who sees the world differently than you do, your investigation goes places you wouldn't expect. You get findings that you don't expect. You have to understand things on a deeper level. And you start to appreciate the complexity of the things that go on. So I think speaking to your base, speaking to people who agree with you, is not the way to go if you want to have an accurate, thorough, credible investigation. And in fact, it can mislead you into ignoring issues. Even when you think you're being fair, when you're only talking to somebody who agrees with you, you just miss things and you mischaracterize things. So I think it's a real problem. There are also other kinds of mechanisms out there that cause additional problems. We now have this pretty amazing thing in the House where they set up this modernizing Congress committee. And I think about the things in the oversight area that need to be modernized. The subpoena enforcement is certainly one of them, maybe one of the most important issues. But you think about just in the House, the budget for the committees goes 2/3, 1/3. If you're in the majority, you get 2/3. You're in the minority, you get half that much, even though the numbers, the split in the House might be 52-48. The Senate used to do that 2/3, 1/3 thing, and we got rid of it about 10 years ago because in the Senate, the numbers have been hovering around 50%, 55% for a very long time. So now the budget split reflects what actually happens, the breakdown of the parties in the Senate. The House should do the same thing. I also think about clerks. Clerks are a very important mechanism to facilitate bipartisan investigations. If you have a clerk who's talking about, don't surprise the other side, have you told the other side, I'm going to give information to everybody at the same time, you have a much more bipartisan experience where people's understanding of the facts mature together. But I found out in the Senate, our clerks get 50% of their pay from one party and 50% of the pay from the other. But in the House, that doesn't happen. And in fact, there's a Democratic clerk and a Republican clerk. Not only is that wasteful in terms of funds, those people don't have the same sort of reason in terms of compensation to be even-handed. So there are a lot of things we might be able to do on a mechanical level to try to encourage bipartisan, very high-quality investigations.
I'll just quickly add that it's sometimes helpful for me to remind myself that every chairman spends more time in their districts back at home than they do here. And when they're back at home, they're meeting with constituents, they're meeting with other folks who are constantly asking, what are you doing about X? What are you doing about Y? And I think that pressure can cause different people to return to Washington and start thinking about how to be able to have an answer for that question the next time they go home and start thinking about using the investigative powers of Congress to help them have a good answer. And that, I think, it takes great discipline to avoid falling into that trap.
John, Stan, did you have anything to add? John, you're going to be, we're coming up on my last question, and you're going to be exempt from it, so I have to give you a substitute question, which is this. Were there, either while you were at House Oversight or now in your current position, are there particular rules of the road or practices that that existed for the staff working together or for the member or for the chair in ranking that helped kind of preserve a culture of bipartisanship if it was there, or helped build one if it wasn't?
There weren't necessarily, you know, anything on paper, but I think we had sort of a gentleman's agreement, and it really related to sort of access to documents, access to information, and information sharing. And I think those are sort of the key principles that can keep you on track for the most part. If the majority receives documents and information, pursue it to a request from the chair, under the House rules, they're obligated to turn over that information to the minority. But in terms of how promptly that occurs, it can vary. And so if there's an understanding that everybody abides by, that you turn over information immediately, you try to make sure that everyone has equal access to witnesses. Anybody who wants to provide information to the committee, both sides have equal access to those people, with the exception of certain whistleblowers. And I think actually I was surprised in the last couple of weeks with the organizational meetings at different committees throughout the House. There were quite a few agreements on the record between the different chairs and ranking members that there would be a bit more advance notice with respect to subpoenas. There would be more of a commitment to information sharing along the lines of, I think, at the staff level, what we had always tried to abide by. Now it's been sort of put on the record in a formal way at these organizational meetings, and I think that's a very positive development.
Well, my final question is, as we have a number of committees that are moving towards some fairly high-profile subjects for inquiry, what advice would you give the Democratic staff and the Republican staff of those committees as they're moving towards these issues and dealing with increasingly difficult and politically charged topics?
Well, from a legal standpoint, I would say simply make sure your ducks are in a row with respect to establishing your jurisdiction and stating clearly the subject under inquiry and how what you are asking for relates to that, and make a record for it. Because it's going to be challenged or tested in some manner, even if it doesn't get to court. And the more disciplined and conscientious you are about establishing that, the more you will, the more they'll be able to demonstrate to the larger public where, in some sense, that they need that support to get this done. It will show that they are on a legitimate path for doing something the Constitution actually confers on the Congress. Just remember that the sine qua non of congressional investigation is the legislative function. Everything that Congress has the power to do stems from its functions as the legislative branch, not as a court, not as a grand jury, not as a megaphone for public dissemination, but to aid itself in the performance of its legislative functions. And they have to keep hewing to that line to show the world, their colleagues, their constituents, maybe a court ultimately, that that's what they're doing.
I've been very nice this whole discussion. I haven't pressed anyone on anything, so I'm going to press you a little bit. That is a fantastic advice, I think, for a chairman and for majority staff. What would you tell a ranking member? What would you tell a Republican staffer in the House who's coming up on one project?
Yeah, I would tell them, to the extent you are forced as the minority to play defense, force those issues on the majority. Make them as the Republican members on the Oversight Committee did with respect to the Michael Cohen issue. Make them appreciate and understand that you have a sense of that and force them through the means that you have available to insist that those demands be made and point to the record where that's not the case if they haven't done it with sufficient and force them to discipline themselves a bit.
Elise?
Well, I guess I'd focus on two things, communication and socializing. So for communication, I would set up mechanisms that force bipartisan cooperation. So all document requests should be signed by both sides if at all possible. Sometimes one side doesn't want to sign on, but you should at least show them your document request before they go out the door. Interviews should be done together. We always shared witness questions ahead of time so that everybody could see what the questions were. Sometimes I would gasp, you showed your questions the other side. I'm like, they're going to hear them. You know, it's like, why don't you coordinate ahead of time so that you can do something in a sensible, efficient way? On hearings, you should show each other what you think the hearing structure should look like, the witnesses that you would like to see, even if the majority retains the final decision-making, instead of saying, these are three hearings, you have 1 week to get your witness, and then the minority runs around and tries to find somebody that's willing to write testimony in, you know, a day or two. It's much better to give people more notice and to have joint press releases about your hearings. It's amazing what you find out in those joint press releases, how you express the issues, what quotes the two bosses are going to use in the same document tends to tamp down rhetoric and actually get each side more informed about how they think about what's going to happen in that hearing. And then have a weekly meeting between the majority staff director and the minority staff director so that on an ongoing basis, there is a meeting where you can discuss things. So those are all sort of communications and mechanisms. And then the other thing I would say, you need to socialize. In the PSI subcommittee I worked on, every 2 to 3 weeks, we had a little cocktail party. And you weren't allowed to talk about work. You could only talk about movies or significant others or jokes or, you know, lore from things in the past. And to get to know each other. And that really... And we also had a tradition of actually meeting in person, not just doing everything by email where everybody gets kind of snippy. We actually had to meet in person, and you had to go into the other person's territory. You go to their offices. They come to yours. It is a physically difficult thing to do at the beginning. But the more that you do it, you start to feel like, oh, maybe we're a team. After each of our oversight investigations, we took a photograph of the team that worked on that particular issue so you could remember that you worked together. And sometimes we have Senator Levin smiling away in the middle. So looking for those mechanisms to understand each other as people, to form joint understandings of facts, to coordinate what you're doing, all of those are mechanisms that both sides should try to do. I don't mean to imply that this is easy. I spent a lot of times calming down people like, well, so-and-so said such and such. I said, they didn't mean anything by that. Just calm down, you know, because you start to find out there's different language on both sides and different things mean different things to different people. So it's all about that trying to create an investigative team to try to see yourselves as part of a team instead of as adversaries.
I think we have time for some questions. If you have one, please come to the microphone. One main piece of housekeeping that I neglected to address in the beginning, which is that your programs may say that Michaela Carr is joining us on this panel. I think we've demonstrated beyond the shadow of a doubt that she is not joining us for this panel. John is sitting in. She had an emergency, and he, I want to say, has done so ably and with great credit to him and his staff. So, yes.
Hi, Stanley Cook with the U.S. Government Agency, and particularly reflecting on Elsie's advice and observations. I was at one time a U.S. Senate legislative assistant back in Howard Baker's period, and my primary interest or subject was the Senate Public Works. And if I were a Republican staffer and the Republicans were not there, I would go to the Democrats and vice versa. It was a very bipartisan committee. So that can be.
And it's much more pleasant as well.
Yeah.
I should say, so I was a staffer for Dr. Coburn and learned the rules of the road at PSI, which was my first position in Congress. To my shock and dismay, when I came up to the full committee, my next position, they didn't exist. They didn't appear to exist anywhere else I looked. So now the trainings that Elise and I do with oversight staff, we try to drill them into everyone. And hopefully every once in a while someone listens. Yes.
Thank you so much. This has been such a great panel, really interesting, and a great conference. My question is, I would like to hear the panelists' views, just turning to sort of reflecting on the Benghazi investigation. I want to hear your views on sort of what the lessons really are from that project. In particular, you know, it seems like it was actually a very effective political tool that was used with arguably very successful political results. And so the question, I hear what you're saying. The question is, what really are the lessons, I think, in your view, to be learned from that project?
I think that's an example of, Elise gave a few examples earlier of scenarios where, on the one hand, they could be perceived as political and you could ascribe a political motive to the folks running the case. On the other hand, there's also a very legitimate question that connects back to Congress's constitutional authorities. And in that case, I think the question was clear. What went wrong? What were the security vulnerabilities? How do we prevent something like that from happening again? But it quickly became politicized, and I think that key underlying question was forgotten, and that, I think, was a shame.
You know, in the first five hearings on Benghazi, finding out what was wrong and what we should do to prevent it from happening again, you know, those were legitimate questions. But by the time we got to the last one that lasted 11 hours and featured Hillary Clinton, I mean, I watched almost all of that. And I thought she mopped the floor with every member of Congress in that committee. And the questions were poorly focused. They didn't seem to make a lot of sense. I thought it was a huge embarrassment to Congress. I thought it was an example of oversight that was dysfunctional. There was very little coordination between the two sides. It was, to me, political theater. It was not about making improvements to policy or informing Congress or acting as a check on another branch of government. So I didn't think it was a successful hearing, the last one. The first few, I thought, were very important and successful, getting out a lot of information that wasn't known. But by the time you got to that last one, I didn't feel that way. I'll tell you what I really think, right?
Thank you all very much. Given the difficulties with respect to subpoena enforcement and the reliance of Congress on the judiciary in many instances for that purpose, do any of you have any concrete ideas for ways in which Congress can reduce its reliance on the judiciary and sort of put teeth in congressional contempt or some sort of internal enforcement mechanism that would accomplish the same results without having to rely on the judiciary?
Well, there is another enforcement mechanism, inherent contempt, which is the way they did it in the very old days. That is, and they did it actually in McGrain in 1927. They sent a sergeant at arms out to arrest the miscreant and bring them to the floor of the House or Senate and have a trial, in effect, dispatching the witness to either the basement of the Capitol or the D.C. jail. That seems like an unseemly, unattractive way to proceed at this stage of our development. It could be used. The problem is, ultimately, that's going to get to court. In some ways, that gets to court quicker because the person who's going to be attached goes and files a habeas petition and winds up in front of a federal judge forthwith. So in our system, and back to Senator Graham's, you know, rule of law, there's no way around having the courts at some point decide these if they come to an impasse. You can get there quicker. You can get there more efficiently. You can maybe get there on a scaled down set of issues. But there's no way that these things can be self-executing because our system doesn't work that way.
I think the best thing we could do for ourselves would be to provide faster access to court, some sort of expedited path to getting a judgment quickly. At this point, the executive branch is fully aware. We're on a two-year cycle in the House, and the clock resets every 2 years. And if they can just get to the next election, then the subpoena evaporates. So if there's a way to get a judgment quickly, I think that would help us a lot.
I'm going to exercise my moderator's authority to give my opinion anyway, even though I'm not a panelist. We are relying heavily on subpoenas at this point because a lot of the other options that Congress has to exercise its authorities, Congress has taken away from itself. Also, if Congress was better at passing legislation, we could see more authorizing bills, which are fantastic tools to push mandates and requirements for information reporting and things like this. The appropriations process is littered with opportunities to get better understanding of what's happening in agencies, to understand what's going wrong and what needs to be fixed. But the appropriations process hasn't worked in years. And the staff there who are responsible for getting those answers are screaming and have been screaming. And they probably don't scream anymore because they've been screaming so long. So there are a lot of other things. Nuclear option obviously didn't help in the Senate either with regards to nominees. So Congress has all sorts of great tools, but the internal dysfunction of Congress has also crippled its ability to project its authority beyond its wall.
And don't overlook things like the confirmation authority. I can remember when Sam Ervin held up the nomination of Richard Kleindienst to be Attorney General until Peter Flanagan from the White House agreed to come up and testify. And he made it clear. He said, this nomination will not be considered or go anywhere until you come up and testify. And he showed up and he testified. So there are collateral ways that, you're right, that Congress could put pressure on. The problem is those have withered on the vine through the decades.
I had a question following along the theme of it takes a lot of time to enforce the subpoena, and I was curious for thoughts on whether or not you think we'll see more of some of the mechanisms that have been used to expedite proceedings, given that you're essentially in a posture where without an organic statute giving you expedition, you have to find a procedural way. I guess my first question is, do you think, especially as we see more and more data stored on the cloud by private parties, you're going to see more instances where a governmental agency is investigated by going after the private party who holds their data to force the government to sue to enjoin in the AT&T posture?
Yeah.
Then you're in on a PI. That was the first part. My second question was along what Elise mentioned. Do you think we will see, okay, I'm not going to cite you for contempt, I'm just going to serve the entire general counsel's office with deposition subpoenas, and they can sit there and refuse to object, but I'll take a deposition for 3 days and ask them 900 questions. And then the third, to your point, Stan, I fully understand the unseemliness of a trial on documents. Did you produce X document? Is there a claim of privilege on an inherent proceeding? But isn't there a certain elegance to the executive's position has gone so far, they just don't show up. And there you're not even in a trial.
Right.
You have Cunningham and other cases say you can just issue the warrant to compel appearance. Isn't there an elegance there to saying, okay, you really want to pull that, we'll fight that in the limited context of do you have to show up? And to your point, yeah, you're in court, but you're in on habeas and a claim of
yes.
Right. And I was just on all of those three,
On the first one with the third parties, I think that I don't think that has a prospect of helping. I think it hurts it because there's a case involving the old John Moss Committee at AT&T where he subpoenaed national security wiretap information from AT&T, just a third party holder. And the Justice Department intervened and blocked AT&T from complying with the subpoena, and there was all kinds of issues about standing and could they intervene, and so that I don't think is likely to quicken or alleviate the problem. I think if anything, it'll complicate it. You're right about habeas, and in fact, in the McGrane case itself, the witness just Mally Daugherty, the Attorney General's brother, just didn't show up. and didn't get respond. And so they sent out the sergeant at arms. So yes, on the point of do you have to show up, leaving aside all the other legal issues, yes, habeas might work. Few people do that anymore, though. As to the depositions, I noticed one change in the House rules, which the Democrats, they restored staff depositions. So now the staff in the House will be able to geometrically expand the reach of their investigative power because they won't have to rustle up a member for 5 hours to sit there and be the presiding officer. So, and I'd be interested what John thinks about that. That will give them, I think, additional leverage.
I think that rule change is very significant. It didn't get noticed too much, but it's going to have a huge practical effect for exactly the reason that Stan just described for the last however many years, whenever we issued a subpoena to compel a deposition. That's the easy part. The hard part is figuring out which member or members are going to set aside however many hours they need to set aside to join us. And that limits you to, you know, the days that you're in session. And the next thing you know, the witness has sort of figured out how to game the system there and put off the deposition for a while. So obviously the Democrats noticed the challenges that we had while we were in the majority in terms of getting those scheduled and working with our members' calendars, which are full, of course. And they made that change. So I think it will be, I think you will see more depositions, more testimony obtained on a compelled basis for that reason.
It'll also give lawyers more chances to obfuscate by objecting to questions. And when the staff orders them to answer, the lawyer will be able to say, well, you don't have authority to do that. Only the committee does. So, you know, it's double-edged sword.
Well, I would say that on the Senate side and PSI, we've been doing staff depositions for decades. And when we would have those kinds of objections, Senator Levin would be available. We could call him on the phone if we wanted to, or we'll say, all right, we'll come back to that and with a ruling and your, you know, client is going to have to come in again. Sometimes a client who didn't want to have to pay the lawyer twice would say, no, and I'll answer it right now.
Although I'll point out there, just not to be overly lawyers about this, but my position on that, if I were representing the witnesses, with all due respect, Senator Levin, you're not the Senate, and only the Senate can enforce a subpoena. So I'm going to stand on my objection, and if you want to make me answer, you go down to the district court and get an order.
It's in our rules.
Right. But, well, again, there's room for legal dispute over whether a single member can enforce a Senate subpoena where the statute says it's the Senate's prerogative to enforce the subpoena. It's a legal issue. So
I would disagree with you, but leaving that aside for the moment, I think one of the big issues here is the Obama administration was pretty obnoxious in a lot of ways in terms of answering information. Their Justice Department and others were pretty outrageous. But the Trump administration has been even worse. And what has really concerned me is when the Ways and Means Committee asked the Treasury Secretary to come in and testify, and he had a week where he was supposed to be at Davos, and because of the shutdown, he couldn't go. So he obviously had an open calendar, but he chose not to. He said, I'm just not appearing. And I think that's pretty rare for the authorizing committee to just be disrespected like that by the Treasury Secretary. The chairman of the Ways and Means Committee just said, well, we'll kind of, he canceled the hearing and he said, we'll deal with it some other way. He's not the only secretary to do that. Secretary of HHS did the same thing with Energy and Commerce, said, I'm just not showing. That's really never happened before. I don't remember where secretaries say, it doesn't matter what date you pick or when you ask me. So it was before, it was like, well, I'm scheduled here, I'm scheduled there. We would say, well, you tell us when you're open, and that's when we'll have the hearing. Now it's like, I'm just not going to show. That is a problem that other countries often have with their oversight efforts, but it has not been a problem in the United States. And again, it comes back to respect for rule of law and to understand that Congress is a co-equal branch. And so that's a real problem that the Congress is going to have to deal with. And at some point, the Congress is going to have to say, you know what? You cannot disrespect us this way, and it's going to depend upon whether we can make that a bipartisan issue. And people always think, you know, we were in the majority, we might be in the minority. It's not like one side is really going to obviously be in charge for a long time, or both sides are at risk of being in the minority. And both sides, we don't know who the next president is going to be. So that gives more of an impetus for both sides to say, this is an oversight problem that we really need to face and deal with.
But I think that's actually spawned by this stalemate in the law over how you get a subpoena enforced, because I think the secretary could say, well, they can't make me because they have to subpoena me, and then we're into, you know, into a fight.
Of course, there are all kinds of other, these other ways to,
yes,
we'll cut off your money,
right,
we won't approve any of your appointees,
but
we won't do,
right,
the program,
but yet they
we
have,
won't allow you
they
to
have to go to that level,
you know, all that stuff.
They have,
well,
to employ those.
Yeah.
I think the recalcitrance is encouraged by the fact that they think that these are, you know, these are purely voluntary exercises.
I think John's right that the recalcitrance is encouraged when it's not a bipartisan issue. And when it becomes seen as a bipartisan issue, it will become much more difficult for the secretaries to resist in the way that they have.
I think that's right. I think when a witness, whether it's a cabinet secretary or a career employee who's been asked to come in for an interview, when that person feels like they will get cover from the other side, there just isn't sufficient pressure in a lot of cases for them to come in immediately. And in most cases, they'll want to demonstrate that they're being reasonable and they'll try to work with the committee. So now I can't come in next Tuesday, but I can come in 3 months. And so that sort of sometimes starts the dialogue, and eventually you get to a mutually agreeable situation. But that diminishes the Article I authorities that we are all trying to protect. I think we're all better off if people are under the impression that when Congress invites you to appear, you show up.
I think Senator won a lot of plaudits for his bipartisanship when Senator Coburn or some of the other Republican partners we had were going after the Obama administration, and Senator Levin would back them up. And he would get on the telephone with the secretary that was refusing to come in and really giving them a hard time, getting them to come in or their staff to come in. That's how you win a lot of bipartisan respect, and you start to see yourself as a team, is when one side is willing to do that for the other side.
I would also note very briefly, and I want to get to what I think is going to be our last question, but in not across the board, but in some of these cases like Mnuchin and Nielsen and Whitaker also, they don't have extensive experience necessarily dealing with congressional oversight and don't understand. And I would contrast actually the Benghazi hearings with Hillary Clinton, who very effectively turned a hearing, an appearance at a hearing, into political communication, and really changed the cast of how that investigation and that hearing certainly was perceived. Those are opportunities for cabinet members often to come up before a committee, argue on behalf of their administration on what they're doing, on the choices the president's made, and turning those down, I think, all of the other questions of authorities and whatnot aside, is disappointing. Yes.
Yes, I'm Bill Murphy with Good Government Now. On the issue of subpoena enforcement, my organization has presented a proposal to try to revive and reform and make the inherent enforcement procedure more usable by replacing arrest and detention as the primary sanction with monetary fines, so limiting that to fines. I would. We also have a procedurally to reduce the amount of time that the procedure would take, primarily by reducing floor time, using a select committee to do most of the investigative and preparatory work. I would just like the comment of the panelists on that. And relatedly, this links to the questions about civil enforcement. We've gotten to civil enforcement. You all mentioned how there's been a deterioration in congressional authority. A lot of that has been systematically pushed by the executive branch. Some of it voluntarily, Congress stopped using inherent enforcement, but now for the last 11 or 12 years, the executive branch has pretty much stymied the ability to use criminal enforcement. Now, with those two gone, that really means Congress has no direct personal or individual sanction that it can place on a recalcitrant witness. So would trying to make inherent contempt more workable be beneficial that way? And also, given that the executive branch has tried to deny Congress the opportunity to use inherent and criminal contempt and to force it into civil enforcement, the reason for this is civil enforcement really doesn't put a credible threat of punishment on the individual witness. Is Congress making a mistake trying to make civil enforcement work better? I'm not saying that it shouldn't be done, but to make that the exclusive focus. So those would be my two questions.
I think there is some affection for those ideas, certainly in the House, and Mr. Issa introduced a bill that had a lot of those, incorporated a lot of those ideas. It passed through the Judiciary Committee. I think it passed the House unanimously, or at the very least with bipartisan support. So I think there are some, those ideas have some traction.
Yes, I think those are ideas that ought to be explored and pursued on the theory that there has to be some effective way to enforce congressional subpoenas. How best that is achieved is a question, and I think some of those ideas are worth looking at.
Great. Thank you, Bill. I'm glad you're here to make that point. That wraps up our panel. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. There's one more question. Sir, please.
I just wanted to comment that I think that this discussion is vital to the image of lawyers, and that there's not been enough attention, discipline, ethics applied to the topic. Today, there's, I think the whole legal system gets a bad image from investigations where there's no predicate act, but they nail somebody and ruin his reputation for a misstatement or a lie in giving testimony. And then we have the situations of raids, which I don't think really enhance the image of law enforcement. And people being called in for investigation or for questioning when they're not sure whether they really should bring a lawyer because they don't know whether they are, in fact, the subject of an investigation. So there's a lot of profound issues that you've touched upon, and you're dealing with what I would classify as quasi-judicial process, because you're not in court with a predicate act or a lawsuit. You're investigating, which is a very amorphous topic, and it opens up as you say, passing documents over the transom, and the person doesn't know that the documents are already released and he's being investigated, and then he ends up, there's no ultimate real predicate charge against him. He gets hit with tax evasion it's shortcut legal process by the Justice Department.
If I can just respond to that, Congress is not like a prosecution. They can't throw anybody in jail except for maybe for contempt, but they don't send people to jail as a punishment. They don't fine people. It has to be done for policy purposes.
But they can ruin people. They can ruin people and get the legal process off on the wrong footing. And I've just had too many experiences where I did better with a Freedom of Information request than I did trying to get discovery out of a lying lawyer.
Good point.
Okay, with that, I think we should give our great panel a round of applause.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/Article I. That's fedsoc.org/Article I.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.